And good morning, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, April 3rd, 2013. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest this morning is mystery writer and journalist Hillary Davidson. She got her start in journalism in 1995 when she moved to New York for 5 months to intern at Harper's Magazine. Afterwards, Hillary joined the staff of Canadian Living magazine in Toronto as a copy editor. Her first freelance article, Death Takes a Holiday, about a New Orleans cemetery, was published by the Globe and Mail. She left her day job to write full-time in June 1998. And Hillary's work as a travel writer has allowed her to visit places such as Peru, Easter Island, and Israel. Ironically, Hillary has spent much of her time writing books about her hometown, Toronto, and her adopted city, New York, where she's lived since October 2001. She's written 18 nonfiction books, 17 of them for Frommer's Travel Guides. In 2008, she launched the Gluten-Free Guidebook, a website for people with celiac disease and gluten intolerance. Her debut novel, The Damage Done, won a 2011 Anthony Award for Best First Novel and Crime Spree Award. I will be able to talk at some point soon, I hope. I'm just getting some coffee down. For Best First Novel, the book was also a finalist for the McCavity Award and an Arthur Ellis Award. The novel's main character, Lily Moore, is, like Hillary, a travel writer. The second book in the series is The Next One to Fall, and the third is Evil in All Its Disguises, that was published on March 5th of this year. And that's the book we're gonna discuss today. There's so much more to say about her. Her short stories have appeared in a variety of places, and I want to talk about that. And she has served as at-large director on the National Board of the Mystery Writers of America since January 2012. She's on the board of MWA's New York chapter. Let's bring her on and talk more. Hi, Hillary.
Hi, Barbara. Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction.
Oh,
you're so kind.
It's great to have you. It's really a pleasure, actually. I very much am enjoying your book. And I find it just so interesting. Well, so much is interesting. The crossover between travel writing and mystery writing. And we're going to talk about that later on. But let's first talk about this book, and then we'll cover some of the terrain that we probably covered when you were on with the first novel.
Sure.
So, yeah, talk about Evil and All Its Disguises and how it came about.
Oh, gosh. Well, I feel in a sort of strange way. It's kind of like my gothic novel. I had a very distinct idea for the first three books in this series, and I wanted the first one to be sort of a traditional mystery and the second one to be more of a thriller. And the third one, I had all of these sort of gothic ideas about almost like going into a castle that no one really can escape from or leave, and have it be this sort of very isolated kind of setting, which is a really stark contrast to, for instance, the second book, which is set in Peru and which sort of takes you all over Peru and is almost like a travelogue as well as a mystery. But it was also the first book that I've ever written that was really inspired by a real-life story that I guess it's something that I've really had in mind for a lot of years now. You mentioned that I wrote guidebooks for Frommer's for about a decade, and in May 2000, one of our editors actually went missing while on a press trip. She was actually in Jamaica, and she was there kind of accidentally. She had been on a press trip that was supposed to go to Cuba, and they had been turned back at the last minute, and she and a few other journalists were kind of unexpectedly landed in Jamaica, split up between a couple of different resorts, and just sort of left to their own devices. And she was a really experienced traveler, really smart person, and she went missing one day. It was just sort of out of the blue. No one really noticed at first except the maids who were cleaning her room, who reported to the hotel that the guest hadn't been in her room, that she wasn't sleeping there, but that her stuff was still in the room. But the hotel didn't report this to the authorities. And fast forward a few days after that, when the editor was supposed to have come home, both her bosses at Frommer's and her parents both couldn't get in touch with her, couldn't find her at all, so they contacted the hotel. And the hotel apparently said that the guest had checked out. And so her parents, getting into a panic, called the police. When the police went there, they found actually that this woman's passport was still in the safe in her room. Her purse was still there. Her money was still there. Her suitcase, her clothes, all of these things were there, but that she was gone. And there's a sort of sense, a lot of these sort of island resorts, they make you feel very safe and very comfortable when you're there. And some of them, the ones I've visited anyway, will always warn you about how dangerous it can be to leave their grounds. But in this case, this was actually a journalist just disappearing from the grounds. And it's a really sad story because no one really knows what happened to her. Her parents worked with the police, and they worked with private investigators, and they have a pretty good idea, though the person they believe responsible for her disappearance has never been arrested. Nothing has ever happened to him. And her body has never been found. They've had her legally declared dead in court, which made it easier, actually, to pursue the case and to investigate it. And that was because the resort was trying to play it that, well, she must have just left and gone off on her own, and they can't be responsible for that. But it's a really kind of worst-case scenario, and I'm someone who passionately loves travel, but as a female travel writer who I was just a year younger than this editor, and she was a lot savvier about travel than I was, that was something that I honestly have carried with me on every trip I've been on since, and especially when I'm traveling alone, that is something that's always in my mind. And the book really spiraled out of that. It's not in any way an attempt to tell the real story about what happened to that editor, and that's part of the reason why I moved it to Acapulco and put it in a completely different location and have a different sort of story building out of it. But what gripped me was this kind of scenario of an experienced traveler just suddenly going missing at the property and the property trying to cover it up. And those are the things that worked their way into Evil in All Its Disguises.
Interesting. So she was never found.
No, her body was never found. They went to court in 2002 to have her declared dead because for a time the resort was, it's a terrible thing to say, but it was almost as if they were obstructing the investigation. It seemed that the staff on the property were very concerned, but that the people who were in charge wanted to play it, that the journalist had probably run off. They actually claimed that she had been using drugs and flirting with men in the bar and that sort of thing, and, you know, just sort of playing it as if, well, you know, they couldn't say what happened to her, but she was kind of a crazy character, and who knows what she might have gotten into. And that was really something that they did, I think, because they wanted to protect their bottom line. And when you've got a resort and a destination that is so heavily dependent on tourism, then you can have a situation where I guess some people feel it's in their best interest to downplay the possibility of any crime and even sort of misdirect the police in terms of how they represent things and how they, you know, the information that they give them in the course of their investigation.
Interesting. You mentioned, Gothic mysteries and Gothic qualities, and I was thinking that when I, early on, you have a description of Lily on the elevator, and the elevator doors open onto a floor that is not being used, and it's dark, and that was so creepy. staying in a hotel.
As a travel journalist, it's funny because sometimes you visit hotels often in their off season, and you're not seeing them at their best and when they're full. And I've actually been in hotels where there have been parts that have been shut down. And to be honest, it's very creepy to be, no matter how beautiful the hotel is, it's very creepy to be in a place that's kind of isolated and empty like that.
Yeah. You know, there's a hotel that went up a few years ago on the way from L.A., Orange County to Palm Springs. And, you know, the whole time, as it started going up, it's like, what is that? It's too narrow to be a hotel. It ended up being this big old hotel now. But I still remember it as being this dark kind of structure that went up and just looked like this otherworldly eye or something. And I will never go there.
Right. Well, the thing with hotels, too, is that hotels often have hidden places in them by design because there's this idea of what the guests are supposed to see. And if it's a luxurious hotel, and certainly the one in the book is supposed to be, then they're supposed to see these grand public rooms and the guest rooms are supposed to be lovely. But, you know, some hotels will try to disguise the presence of staff moving throughout the hotel because they don't necessarily want people to sort of see a lot of activity going on, people running around and carrying things and, you know, dirty laundry being carried out and that sort of thing. So there are always like these hidden passageways and chutes and things like that. So it's kind of fun to play with that idea as well. You know, if you were just putting up an office building or an apartment tower, there would be fewer little hidden areas within that structure, I think, than an old hotel.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I am with Hilary Davidson. Her new novel is Evil in All Its Disguises. When you began with the first book, did you count on Lily being a series character? I mean, did you have an idea for a series of novels that were going to focus on her as being the main character and what she goes through as an amateur PI?
I did. I had actually always envisioned it as a series, and I felt embarrassed initially admitting that because I wasn't sure whether I'd ever be able to sell one book, let alone two books or a series of books. And when I did get my first book deal with Tor Forge, it was for two books. And so I knew that there would be two books with Lily, but I wasn't sure whether there would be a third. And it was really important to me because I, for some reason, I think in threes. I think it's just sort of the story arc in my mind. There's an arc within each book, but then there's part of a larger arc, and the first three books are sort of all part of it. And I was really nervous that I would be kind of, you know, if they didn't give me another contract after that, I would be leaving her at this place and no one would ever really know how her story was supposed to go. So I did envision it as a series, but it made me very, very nervous. I guess for me, part of the fascinating thing about writing an amateur sleuth and what makes it believable to me is that you have to have the character change a lot based on their experiences. I mean, the things that Lily goes through when she's searching for her sister in the first book, it traumatizes her in a lot of ways. And in the course of that book, she's forced to confront parts of her past that she's run away from. She's forced to confront things about her own life and the people that she's let into it, things that she's really tried to run away from. I mean, not only is she a travel writer, but she's someone who kind of dropped her life in New York and ran off to Spain before that book began. So she's not someone who really confronts things. Her instinct is normally to run. And in the course of that book, she starts to change, and the book leaves her in a very dark place at the end because she discovers that many of the people she's trusted have, you know, they've been lying to her or they've betrayed her in some way. She's sort of forced to confront reality, but it leaves her in this really dark place, and I never wanted just for the character to be left in that darkness. I wanted to move forward. And then in the next book, part of it is showing her grieving for her old life, for the losses that she suffered. But in the second book, she also starts to regain strength, and it's from a sort of a truer place, I guess, than the sort of sophisticated, glamorous life that she had before that was based on kind of, I don't know, mirror images and shadows and things that weren't real. In the second book, she starts to get tougher and more driven and starts to have a clearer vision about herself and other people. And the third book is almost like the payoff, where she's really kind of earned her wisdom at this point. And it's the first time that she's really been traveling alone. In the first two books, her best friend, Jesse, who he's a travel photographer, and they're very close. They're like brother and sister. And he was there with her basically every step of the way in the first book. And in the second book, he is present throughout. I mean, he's really her anchor. But in the third book, In Evil in All Its Disguises, Lily is actually on her own. So she doesn't have that anchoring kind of influence or anyone looking out for her. And so it really is sort of her with what she's learned in the first two books, and all of the strength has to come from her.
Interesting. Talk about the cast of characters you pulled together in this book.
It was kind of fun in a way. Each book is meant to be read as a standalone, so the idea is that you could come into the series at any point and just read that book and hopefully enjoy it. But one of the things that was fun in this one was actually bringing back a few of the characters from the first book. So the scenario with Evil and all its disguises is that Lily is on a press trip in Acapulco when another journalist goes missing. And she and that journalist have a conversation first, and the journalist is really upset, and she's talking about fraud at the hotel and that she's investigating it and seems to have sort of vengeful kind of bent. She wants to get revenge on someone. And then she leaves to take a phone call and never comes back. And it's a little after that that Lily starts to piece things together. Lily didn't realize that just before she went down on that press trip that her former fiancé's company, he owns a hotel company, he had just bought that hotel. And he's a very shady character named Martin Sklar, who, if you read the first book, he is most certainly not a character you would trust. And so all of those accusations of hotel fraud and sort of strange goings-on start to ring true. They no longer sound so paranoid to Lily because she knows that her former fiancé is involved. And, you know, the last time that she saw him, she hit him in the face, and it was not a good parting in any way. So it brings him back, and I think in some ways it's a little bit surprising, though. I think the reader is maybe so primed to hate him that in a way this book lets you see him in a bit of a different light. But he's definitely a sketchy character, and his henchmen are also sketchy characters, so the book certainly explores some of that world. But it also brings back Lily's romantic interest from the first book. There's a New York cop named Bruxton that, during the course of the first book, she sort of develops, well, she's flirting with him, but she actually develops a very genuine affection for him and an attraction to him. And it's clear that it's mutual, but it's also clear that Lily is in no way ready to pursue anything like that in the first book. Like I say, it's kind of a traumatic book for her, and she's actually very conscious at the end of not wanting to get romantically entangled with anyone because she just feels like she would cling to them like a life raft and, you know, not actually be able to have a good relationship with someone, but that she would just be clinging. But in this book, she's been through a lot more, and some time has passed, and he's someone that she calls on. It's not as if he can run down and rescue her, but she starts to call him when things go wrong at the hotel after she realizes that this journalist really is missing and she can't get the hotel to report it to the police, and she finds actually how complicated it is in Acapulco to try to report anything to the police. So she turns to him, and he sort of turns into her lifeline in a lot of ways. And I don't know if it's too spoilery to say that the book actually ends in New York. So she does, at the end of the book, get to go back to the city. So he physically appears in the book as well. But it was really fun to bring him back, actually, because he's someone who... it's like having someone who lives in your mind. You know, they're very present in your consciousness, even though they're not physically there, and that's how he is for Lily. So it was actually very exciting to bring them back together again.
Speaking of New York, you know, writing about a place you know can be difficult, especially if you live there. You know, you live in New York, you write about it, and yet you're able to see it as someone who perhaps has never lived there, never even visited. How do you do that? How do you write about a place that, you know, to be able to see it as again, as someone who's never been there?
Right.
Would see it?
For me, I guess it always comes first and foremost from character. And it's such a great question because I was just on a panel at a conference called Left Coast Crime where I was with a group of other writers, and all of them were saying that for them, the setting kind of informs the story and it shapes the characters and shapes the plot. And for me, it's actually completely the opposite. And I think this might come a little bit from the background of travel writing where I feel that I've written about New York, for instance, hundreds of times, or I've written about Toronto hundreds of times, or there are different places I've covered in different magazines, and I'm always aware of who the audience is that I'm writing for. So if I'm writing about New York for a magazine that's catering to parents of young children, then I'm looking through a very different lens than I do if I'm writing for a magazine that's catering to, luxury travelers who are foodies, who, you know, want the best restaurant experiences and things like that. And so when I'm writing fiction, it's not that different in that my perspective has been through a particular set of eyes. It's always told through Lily's perspective. And so I feel like you learn a lot about the character by what they notice and by sort of what they react to. And so it sort of reflects the character's emotional state in a way. So, for instance, when I was writing about New York and the damage done, there's a lot that's kind of, I guess, going back to the Gothic side of the city. It's sort of dark and shadowy, and even when there is something that's bright and shiny and new, like a new hotel, there's kind of a dark backstory to it. It'll be, built on the site of a church that was burned down in an arson. And so there were these sort of, I use real locations for the most part. I only use fake locations when I'm worried that someone would sue me. So otherwise, it's all real locations that are in the book. But it is something that is meant to show you a lot about the character. It's really her journey, her perspective. I feel that with travel, you could have 1,000 people go through exactly the same course. You could chart a course for them for a day or for a week through a particular city, and everyone would have a really different experience based on what's going on inside their own heads, mm-hmm. because certain things will bring up certain memories and bits of conversation or a movie they saw or a story they heard. And so it's like that for the character as well, that things trigger these, memories of her mother or memories of something in her life, and that's a lot of what shapes her journey. So it's very personal.
Interesting. I'd love to hear you read from Evil in All Its Disguises. Okay, let's hear.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is from Evil in All Its Disguises, and the passage I'm reading takes place at about 11 chapters into the book, and so Lily arrived at the hotel late on a Friday evening, and she met this journalist that she knows quite well, Sky McDermott, and they had a drink at the bar, and then that was when Sky left to make a phone call and never came back. And so the next morning, Lily is actually still left holding on to this woman's purse. She's been talking to people at the hotel, talking to the manager and the person who organized the press trip about Sky, and she keeps getting told, oh, well, everything is fine. She probably, just left the hotel, or it's not a big deal, don't worry. But Lily is starting to get worried, and at this point in the story, she's left the main building, and she's on the hotel grounds, and she's starting to explore, and it just kind of deepens her sense of what sort of dread, I guess, about the place. I'm just going to read a little bit from this section.
Okay.
Sheltered in a grove of trees, I stared at the facade of the Hotel Saron. The sky had turned several shades darker, and instead of sunlight warming the structure's stark edges and angles, the gray veil of menacing weather made it more grim. It looked as if the life had been sucked out of the place, and all that remained was a neat stack of hollow bones. It didn't help that there wasn't a soul moving around the hotel. I stared at window after window, my eyes tracing up its full 5 stories, expecting someone to appear at any moment. The drapes were drawn in all but a handful of rooms, but the ones that were exposed had no lights on inside. The glass looked dark. Perhaps it was tinted to compensate for what was surely blazing sun for most of the year. The only indication that I wasn't completely alone was the occasional sound of a car on the road, which was hidden by a tall hedge with a wall backing it up. There was an opening on the other side of the property and another pathway, and I wanted to see where it led. The stone path was slick from the rain, and I moved as quickly as I dared. The hotel's windows were like 100 black eyes on me. Once my back was to them, I was filled with the heavy, unshakable sense of being watched. Stop being ridiculous, I told myself, looking around yet again. There's no one there. The pathway on the other side of the hotel was a short one, but it changed styles in the middle so that the Saron's slippery stones were replaced by wide flagstones that made it easier to move forward. The path opened suddenly to a small clearing that was filled with the skeletal remains of 36 small bungalows. No, not remains, I realized, taking in the scene. There were construction supplies and equipment littering the ground. The bungalows were still in the process of being built. They didn't have proper pathways between them, just rows of packed-in mud. My pretty flip-flops were going to be goners after this, I realized, as I stepped through the muck. Maybe the earth was used to the constant precipitation it got at this time of year, which was why I didn't sink into it, though the mud clung to my shoes and slowed me down. I peered into one bungalow, which seemed almost ready for human habitation. All someone had to do was tear off the clear plastic that shielded the window openings and fill them with glass instead. The next house I looked at was further from completion. The inside needed drywall, but it already had a snake lying on the floor. I was about to look into the next one when a hand grabbed my shoulder and pulled me back, off balance. Turning my head, I saw a man who was about my height. His pie-round face and sparse scraps of beard made him look like a kid starting high school, but he was holding a gun and pointing it at my chest, and once I noticed that, his age didn't matter. He watched me, and I watched the gun. That standoff went on for an eternity. I felt as if I were sinking, but I couldn't take my eyes off the gun. When I tipped to one side, I looked down and saw that one of my feet was completely submerged in the mud. His eyes followed mine, and he started to chuckle. The gun bobbed from side to side. "It's not funny," I muttered. He gave me a broad grin, flashing yellow teeth, and lowered the gun so that the muzzle could brush against his jeans. "Soy un huésped en el Hotel Saron," I said. "I'm a guest at the Hotel Saron." "Lo sé," he answered. "I know." His tone was careless, as if the difference between shooting me and not wasn't such a big deal. I looked down again and tried to pull my foot out of the mud. That was easy enough, except that the flip-flop stayed planted. I tried to lift it out with my toes and failed. Finally, I bent down to retrieve it. He went from chuckling to laughing in earnest, making his belly wobble. When I finally extracted the shoe, I moved to one side, and he got serious again, gesturing with the gun to move to the other side. He kept that up while we retraced my original steps along the path, stopping briefly to stuff my muddy foot into the unrecognizable flip-flop. He shadowed me all the way back to the front door of the hotel, frequently mumbling to himself and giggling along the way. The man-boy seemed like a perfect fool, but he was a fool with a gun, and there was a peculiar terror in that. It wasn't unreasonable that a guard would be watching over the construction site. Mexico was a poor country, and even in a wealthy one, it wouldn't be unusual to have someone watching over building materials that weren't locked up. But the giddiness made him seem out of control, and if he didn't plan to shoot me, there was a 50-50 chance of it happening anyway. When we reached the hotel's front door, a bellman stood there, and the two nodded at each other. The bellman held the door open, staring at my feet and the mud I tracked in. The guard said, "La premia," sarcastically calling me a prize, or perhaps something worse in Mexican slang. And he laughed, but the bellman didn't join in. Inside the double doors, soaking in the cool air, I turned back and saw the bellman yelling at the guard. I couldn't hear a word, but I watched as the bellman shoved him, knocking him to the ground. "What happened to you?" the clerk at the reception desk asked. It was the same man who'd been there the night before. "Long story," I murmured. When I turned back to look at the scene outside, both the bellman and the guard were gone.
Thank you so much. That was Hilary Davidson reading from Evil in All Its Disguises. We're not going to do a musical break today because there's a lot to talk about, but let me just say that the views that you hear on this show are mine and those of my guests, and not the views of the University of California, Irvine Regents. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org and iTunes College Radio. Gosh, you know, there's so much left to talk about, and I'm going to try to start with what perhaps are more important questions than least important. But one thing I always wonder about, especially with fiction, especially with mystery fiction, is how much you know before you begin, and how much plot you need to know before you begin. With evil in all its disguises, were you headed to a certain point? Did you know what the end point was?
Not at all. I feel so embarrassed admitting this because I know some mystery writers who they outline and, you know, really intensely outline and... You know, they know all of these things. I remember meeting Jeffrey Deaver at Thriller Fest last year, and he says he writes an outline that's up to 150 pages before he actually starts writing the novel. And that made my head explode because, in all honesty, I have tried to outline, and I always describe myself as a failed outliner because when I was writing the first book, The Damage Done, I did have an outline for that book, and it deviated so early, and the final book was nothing like it. If I wanted to sort of go back and write that outline, I guess I still could because it turned out so differently in every way. I have a really strong sense in mind of the opening scenario. I always know sort of where the book begins and sort of what the themes are and kind of what's important to the main character. It's like I know emotionally sort of what Lily is going to go through and what her journey is, but in terms of the plot details and knowing how things happened or how they connected, I do not know. And the best way I've heard it described, I think it was the Irish writer Ken Bruin who described it as driving at night in the rain. You know, you've got your wipers going, and you can only just see maybe a couple of feet ahead of you in the rain, if you're lucky. And that, for me, is what writing is like, where when I sit down, I often do not know where I'm going. And that used to really slow me down, because the very toughest thing I find is the kind of connective tissue of the plot, all of the things that have to happen to make the plot believable and to make it realistic, because you can't suddenly in chapter, you know, 15 have a character do something completely out of the blue, out of character for them. You can have surprises, but you can't just have people randomly doing things because you need them to for plot reasons. So you have to lay down all of this groundwork early on. So what I've learned to do is my first drafts are, it's almost like I write in scenes. Like I start with this opening scenario, and then I know what Lily will do. I know how she'll respond emotionally. And I don't necessarily know what the other players are going to do or how they figure into it, but I know what her reaction is going to be. And so in this book, I knew that she wasn't going to be able to just let it go, even though other people are telling her, oh, don't worry about it. You know, Sky's gone off before. She does these things. It's not a big deal. You know, and then when they start making more sinister claims about her, that she's been using drugs and, you know, this sort of thing, I knew that Lily wasn't going to turn away from that. And part of that comes from what she's learned in the first two books. I just knew that this is not a character who is going to be able to let go and not be worried about someone who might be in trouble. She tends to project, and she thinks a lot about her sister and her sister who used a lot of drugs and sort of the issues that she had and times when she had to rescue her. And that really plays out in her mind. It makes her think, well, this woman might be in trouble too, and maybe she needs my help, and I really do have an obligation to do something to help her. So I know Lily's reactions, and I know how she'll proceed, but I write from scene to scene, kind of, you know, knowing that a certain confrontation has to happen or a certain discovery has to happen. And then it's in my second draft that I actually go back and I start looking at it from a plot point of view, and what I think of as the connective tissue, all of the scenes that have to happen to make those major scenes work, that's when I start putting that in. So I feel like I kind of have this weird backfilling process where my first draft is almost stream of consciousness, just scenes that are playing out in the back of my mind. And then in the second draft, that's where I really start to connect all of those things. So I go through a process of writing, it's easily three or four drafts before I would let anyone see any of my books. You know, they're just not ready for human eyes to ponder them at all early on. So it's definitely, I guess I pay for, you know, the writers that sit down and outline and spend all the time doing that. I guess they do that up front, and I do it later in the process, just by writing so many different drafts.
That's really interesting. Well, we met through the American Society of Journalists and Authors, and so I've watched you go from being a journalist to being a journalist and a fiction writer. And I am curious how journalism fits in to, you know, mystery writing, or what the crossover is from travel writing to mysteries.
Oh, gosh, it's been helpful in so many different ways. And I think at the very beginning, the thing that I found the most helpful was that being a journalist trains you to ask questions and to kind of question everything. And so it made it really easy for me to approach people when I needed information or when I needed help. I kind of had this journalist mentality that if I ask experts, they will answer my questions, which probably sounds very arrogant and terrible. It's just that when you're a journalist, that's how you approach a story. You have questions, you know someone else has answers. And so it didn't really occur to me that people wouldn't be interested in answering my questions. And, you know, people are insanely helpful. It made me feel very, I guess, relaxed about reaching out to people. I was always very upfront. I never represented it as, you know, I'm working on an article. It was always, you know, I'm working on a novel, and this is what I'm doing. And I find that people are very generous and very helpful. So part of it was kind of training me, I guess, to get answers to my questions. Also, though, I like to work in very realistic settings and scenarios. The strange thing is that so much in my books is based on the real world. And so in my second book, the next one to fall, the one that's set in Peru, I used so many real Peruvian settings that the Peruvian Tourism Board actually bought boxes of the book to give away at trade shows, to give away as prizes. I found it incredibly amusing and incredibly sweet. And there was a part of me that thought, wow, I don't know that any article that I've ever written has had that impact, that it's made, you know, a tourism bureau say, oh, we should be giving this to people. It'll make them want to visit, you know, our country. So it actually let me play with a lot of things that I was interested in. I loved, for instance, I was just fascinated at that book with the Inca history and the Inca sites. And, you know, they're such a mysterious people because they didn't leave behind a written language. So we don't know how they did a lot of the things they did. We don't know how they built the structures that they did in an earthquake zone. I mean, the colonial structures just fall down in earthquakes, and the Inca structures don't, even though they're built without mortar. It's like all these wonderful mysteries. And I went there as a journalist, and I was writing articles about the place, but none of the articles that I wrote let me explore those things. And I have there's a writing instructor that I studied with named Susan Shapiro, who's a terrific writer in her own right, who's a member of ASJA as well, actually. And she always says, write about your obsessions. And so I feel like, as a journalist, there were certain things that I just really love and gravitate to, but that I often didn't get to write about those things in the stories because I was writing for a particular audience. And, you know, those things just, with the word count, they just didn't fit into the story. And so I kind of have this collection of things that deeply fascinated me, and they're all real things, and they go into my books. It's just sort of like, in the strangest way, you know, you think fiction, that you're just making all of this stuff up. But for me, it's easier to write fiction that's grounded in reality. For me, the fictitious part are, you know, these characters that I've sort of dreamed up. They have their own lives. They have their relationships, their histories. All of that I have to make up. But everything around them, the world that I put them in, I like that to be as realistic as possible, and that definitely had its grounding in, you know, training as a journalist.
Interesting. You publish a lot of short stories. You have a lot of short stories in anthologies, and so I'm curious when the short stories come in or what they serve in terms of your writing, because, you know, short stories are so different from writing novels. They're
right.
So much more abbreviated and in ways, I think, more difficult. But talk about that, you know, just the difference between publishing short stories and novels and why you do.
I love writing short stories, and I feel that part of the reason is that I have so many ideas for different characters and different scenarios and different things that I want to explore, but not all of these ideas are in any way sort of novel worthy. I mean, and by that I mean they're just not big enough that you could fill a novel with it. You know, there's a particular voice that I hear of a character, or there's a particular scenario. And a short story lets me, in 4,000 words or 5,000 words, lets me run with it and lets me explore sort of different ways of storytelling. With the short stories, some of them are told in the first person. Some of them are written by men. Some are elderly people. Some are very young people. It lets me explore these kind of different characters, different histories. You know, there's one, my one recurring character in a couple of short stories I've written is kind of a burned out mob hitman. And it's sort of, it is a fun character just to sort of see things from his perspective. I don't know if I would want to follow him for an entire book, because I feel that would be a very dark place to go. But I'm, you know, I feel like I'm always gathering material. I'm a terrible eavesdropper, so I love people who talk loudly on their cell phones, because I get so much of my material that way. That actually has literally inspired several short stories. People just saying the most, I mean, not thinking about everyone else around them who might be listening to these very personal things that they're saying. And so I feel like the short story is kind of my way of making use of that, that I would never get to sort of write all of the novels that I dream of writing. I've got, you know, little sketchy, and I've just little paragraph here or there of kind of idea for a character, for a book, or for a story. I have hundreds of these things. And, you know, I really love the kind of playful aspect with the short story. They are very difficult because you have to nail everything down so precisely. You have a really tight word count. And so it's not like a novel where you have room to explore a character over time and to slowly reveal these things about them. With a short story, you somehow have to manage to get exactly the right sort of salient points about that character across, and you have almost no time to do it, and you can't weight that story down with backstory. So it's this incredibly, I think it's a very difficult balancing act, but if you can do it well, it really helps your writing. It really helps you shape things. I think it helps you write dialogue more succinctly, just because you're forced to. You have very little maneuvering room, and so it kind of, it just makes you write much more tightly than, you know, than you might try with a novel. I know my earliest attempts with writing fiction were attempts at writing novels, and they just kind of meandered all over the place when I didn't know what I was doing. And it wasn't until I started writing short fiction, I started writing short stories in 2006, and a funny thing was, early on, I noticed that my writing speed with fiction and nonfiction was so different. I could write, say, a 1,000-word story that was a nonfiction story in a couple of hours and just be done with it. That would be it. If I wrote 100 words of fiction in 2 hours, that was a really good fiction writing day. It was just like a snail's pace. But it's like a muscle that gets exercised and started to get a little bit faster, started to get a little bit better at it. And the more I did it, sort of the easier it got. And so the stories are really like a training ground for me. But I don't mean to make that sound as if you move past it. I am still writing short stories. I love it. I feel that going back and forth between novels and short stories really just helps me as a writer overall. They kind of use different parts of the brain, too.
Hmm. And you have quite a few short stories published. So I am curious if you, once you're done with a piece, do you just simply send it out? Do you have a list of publications and you send it out until it's placed? Or how does that work? I mean, do you get rejected, or are your stories just snapped up as soon as you send them out?
Well, I certainly got a lot of rejection early on. It took me a very, very, very long time to get my first short story published, and I was rejected by pretty much everybody in the course of that before an online magazine called Thuglet picked it up. And that was after about a year and a half of solid rejections from everyone. And I was very lucky because even though I didn't get paid for that story being published, it got picked up for a Best of the Year mystery anthology, and that helped me get my agent. That was all really good. And to be honest, I thought at that point, sort of like, woo, I've made it, you know, this will be great. And then I actually had just as difficult a time getting my second short story published. It was no easier. It was still, you know, a solid year of rejection, and I ended up finally going to Thuglit and asking them if they wanted it, and they did. They have been very kind to me. I think they published my first three short stories before anyone else had any interest. Now it is a little bit different in that sometimes I write short stories that are, I'm asked to be in a particular anthology or I'm asked to be in a particular publication, and so I'm writing a short story that, you know, with that publication in mind. But I still do stories that I just write them up. I have the idea. They're not for anyone in particular. And then when I'm done, I start to think, you know, who am I going to send this to? And that can be difficult. I did one last year that it was about a 9,000-word short story, which is massive. I mean, nobody publishes, you know, it's a novella at that point. It's just massive. It's too short to be a novel, but too long to be a short story.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent it to Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine because, I mean, they're doing wonderful things. And I had one story in the magazine, and they had they'd been very supportive. They'd given it a Reader's Choice Award and all of these things, so it done pretty well there. And the editor got back to me and about this really long, long, long story that I sent them, and she actually really enjoyed it. And she said, well, we would love to publish it, but we need you to cut it down by about 1,000 words because we cannot publish anything that's longer than about 8,000 words. So she really helped me actually pare that story down, which I think it's much better for being pared down. And that's kind of an example where I feel very lucky because I had a relationship with the magazine already. I think it meant that she was willing to take a chance on my kind of crazy, overly overgrown short story. but for the most part, I guess, these days, a lot of stuff that I write is for particular anthologies or for particular publications. There's a new one that Macmillan is launching called The Malfeasance Occasional, and so a story that I wrote for them is sort of anchoring their first issue, which I think is coming out in the next 3 months or so. So things like that are kind of done for a particular audience, but I think I'll always be writing crazy stories and trying to find homes for them. I think that's, you know, probably what will always happen to some extent.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and we have a few minutes left with Hillary Davidson. We've been primarily focusing on her third novel, Evil in All Its Disguises, published by Thor. And we have a few minutes left, and I wanted to even back up further and ask you about starting to write in the mystery genre as opposed to any other fiction genre. How did that begin?
Oh, it was so intuitive for me. I feel like I never made a conscious choice to write in kind of mystery and crime. A lot of it is probably because I've been immersed in that genre all my life. I grew up reading mystery novels. I think I may have said this last time you interviewed me, but you know, I always blame Nancy Drew as the gateway drug, that sort of gets you in, and then Agatha Christie kind of hooks you, and from there you move on to, you know, Robert B. Parker and Sarah Paretsky and Walter Mosley, and it's this kind of like continuum of crime writers. And it's interesting because I think a lot of people might have an idea of what an Agatha Christie novel is, that you're solving a particular puzzle, which for them may or may not be something that appeals. And to me, a mystery novel or a crime novel can do so much more than that. I feel that those are the novels that really kind of engage with today's social problems, whether it's socioeconomic problems, drug problems. All of these things that are kind of under the surface of society, you can explore those in a mystery novel. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be this idea of solving a puzzle. For me, my books are more about characters than they are about puzzles, which isn't to say that the plot and the mystery isn't important, because it is. But in the course of the books, I'm really interested in exploring, for instance, the impact that someone who's a drug addict, the impact that that has on the rest of their family. My main character's mother was an alcoholic, and I feel that even though her mother died when she was 18, that that is something that haunts her and continues to sort of inform her choices and continues to, it's like a thread, I guess, that connects her with the past, and it's something that she'd never be able to cut herself off from. So I feel that there are a lot of these issues that they work their way into the character, and that is all kind of part and parcel of the mystery. What's the baggage that we're all carrying with us? You know, for everyone it's different, but I think we all have it to some extent. And that's part of what's interesting with writing a mystery, is that you can explore how that character's past makes them respond to what's in front of them. And the different characters in the book, what's the baggage that each of them are carrying? How does that make them respond? What does it make them do? Does it make them run? Does it make them, you know, does it make them confrontational? Does it make them angry? So you kind of get to explore human psychology at a very, it's human psychology under very stressful conditions. In a crime novel, you've kind of got a worst-case scenario because you've got a dead body or you've got a missing person. You've got an extreme situation. And so you kind of get to see human psychology at its best and at its worst. I think there's also kind of a little bit of a craving for justice that's underneath it all. One of the crazy things, you know, sometimes I'll see a news story, and there'll be a, you know, story about a crime, and it's just completely inexplicable and horrifying, and no one can really explain it. And there's just something so upsetting and so painful about that. Whereas in a crime novel, there always has to be some kind of explanation. There always has to be some kind of why that makes sense. You can't just leave readers hanging that somebody just did something because they felt like doing that terrible thing that day. There has to be more of an exploration. And I think there's something very satisfying about that, that in a way it's kind of putting order into the world where there is none.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, I thank you so much. You've given all of us, I think, a mini workshop in writing the mystery this morning.
Oh, Barbara, your questions are so great. I'm totally thrilled to be on your show. And, you know, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And we'll talk soon.
Oh, definitely. Look forward to it.
That was Hillary Davidson. Her novel is Evil in All Its Disguises. And if you want to know more about her, you could go to her website. It's quite a nice website at hillarydavidson.com. And Hillary is spelled H-I-L-A-R-Y, davidson.com. You've been listening to Writers on Writing, and a few things coming up in coming weeks. Actually, this coming weekend is Literary Orange, a one-day readers, writers, panels, little conference, a great, great weekend. You can find out more at literaryorange.org. And then the third weekend of this month is the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books, and there's a website devoted to that, too. And then the last weekend of April is the American Society of Journalists and Authors Writers Conference in New York City. I'll be at all three, so if you're there, come say hi. And that's all we have time for today. If you want to know more about the show or the Pen on Fire Writers Speaker Series, visit penonfire.com. And thank you so much for listening.